Alaska has a tremendous lever from what I've been able to read about your state and resources. One which would make it easier for you than for any one of the other 49 states to implement the kind of policy which Dick Cooley has just enunciated. And that is that I understand that some 99.9% of your land is in some form of public ownership. This means that at the present moment you have control as a society, as a state, and as part of a nation over what is obviously the major economic attraction of this state. Now, it is not apparently the land itself, but the prospect that somewhere over this great extent of land, certain ores, minerals, biological products may be found and exploited in terms of the technology of the time. Mention has been made that Alaska's period of accelerated development is occurring in the latter part of the 20th century, and that the major period of economic development, at least in the 48 states to the south, occurred 100 years ago. And a lot of things have happened since, especially in our concept of how natural resources might be exploited. The principal evidence of the commitments of the states to the south 100 years ago indicated that there was a capital short nation with a great deal of undeveloped land and a vast population which had only its muscular energy to offer. And the Homestead Act was almost an inevitable product of that situation. And it led to the subdivision of lands among hundreds of thousands of people. And one of the problems that we have today in the 20th century in the 48 states to the south is that the kind of management of land carried out by small individuals without much capital, because most families don't have much capital to invest, is inadequate to the task. And we are beginning to see that in order to handle the task adequately, land must be assembled in much larger units to respond to the scale of operations that the end of this 20th century require. Now, you can manage your lands with a completely different concept of how they might be utilized than was possible in an age of capital deficiency. There's capital from all over the world which is ready to invest in Alaska. And you needn't call upon people with small reserves to work on small parcels. Now, if one were to look down on the landscape of the Los Angeles basin, where one of the most rapidly growing metropolitan areas in the world is in the process of evolution, you might be surprised to note that right on the edge of very intensive settlement, there are large open spaces. It seems to be a very curious anomaly. And if you investigate that situation on the land, you'll find that 150 square miles on the edge of the Los Angeles metropolitan area are in the ownership of a single corporation, the Irvine Ranch Corporation. And you can imagine a corporation with this amount of land and the pressures that are exerted by bordering communities to begin their invasion of it. Well, Irvine has responded to that pressure by organizing and developing three new towns. But there's a curious principle which the Irvine Company has introduced into this process. It is not selling any of its land. It is leasing it to developers, to industry, to residential developers for a period of 75 years. It is doing a superb job of planning and execution so that it is a very high-grade environment that is emerging. It has alienated a few hundred acres of its land to the state of California for the building of a university, the State University of California, Irvine. Now, why has an area like this in a nation which so prizes fee simple land ownership gone over so well in a community where the opportunities for speculation in land through sales and capital gains succeeded, at least thus far? Apparently, in our time, people are so mobile and their interests are so subject to change according to the change of the context in which we operate that the idea of anyone living in a community now for the rest of his life after he's bought a house and lot is contrary to the actuality. The average American household to the south now moves once in every 5 years. So there's no realistic expectation that people will live on the land which they develop or, in most cases, buy, so that the lease principle becomes reasonable. And what the people are interested in is the quality of the environment that the Irvine Land Company assures them they will have throughout the period of the lease. This the company can assure them because it has control over the investments in the public facilities that must go into servicing such a community. Just to give you an idea of how much people will pay for such a 75-year lease, I will give you the most extreme example. Some of that land is on the bay across from the community of Newport Beach, and small lots with 50-foot frontage on the beach are leasing for $100,000 for the 75 years. After the 75 years, whatever's been built on that land it can be removed. And, of course, obviously, the expectation is that anything that's built today will be obsolete 75 years from now. I call this, personally, the Irvine Principle. It means that there is evidence in one of the most rapidly growing metropolitan areas of the United States, a willingness to accept environmental quality, excellence of public services in exchange for fee simple ownership. It also means that this land can be recovered as a very large unit some 75 years from now and reorganized in terms of the technology of that time, which will obviously be more sophisticated than the technology of now. It also means that lifestyles which will develop over the next 75 years, and certainly we're witnessing a very rapid change in lifestyles and values at the moment, can be accommodated insofar as the physical environment can possibly accommodate lifestyles. So in a sense, what the Irvine Principle opens up in a community which has been accustomed in the past to the fractionation of land in small parcels allocated in fee simple, and therefore subject to the controls of individuals who have great diverse tastes. And when these diverse tastes are expressed in land development, may conflict certainly with the tastes of one's neighbors. This is what has led to the kind of landscape pollution which is so common to the urban landscape of almost every metropolitan area in the United States. This principle indicates that we could have what I'd call erasable landscapes at foreseeable periods in the future when everything now erected will have been amortized and could be completely reorganized and rebuilt. This, of course, would possibly then induce a kind of new architecture, which I call a Kleenex architecture. Obviously, there wouldn't be such a great investment in structures designed for indefinite permanence. We wouldn't have the Roman attitude of building with stone forever. We would have an attitude of building for temporary periods, recognizing that whatever we know today, whatever we value today, in terms of material things, may alter. And we would be capable then of altering at least the urban landscape, the intensified, intensely developed landscape of our society. If this is so, then the very nature of land is changing. That land might possibly in the future no longer be considered as a commodity, as something to be bought and sold, as it was during the homestead period or allocated by government to settlers, expecting that they would use it forever in some fixed manner, as the farm use of land was characteristic of the last century, but that land would serve more as a public utility, and that its primary purpose would not be what could be gotten out of it by development at the present moment, but to what extent could land contribute to the vitality and effectiveness of whatever institutions might, for a period, be investing and occupying that land. It would make possible a flexible response to changes in demand for more effective economic development and for more satisfying lifestyles. Now, you'd say this kind of land management would call for quite a different type of organization than it has been characteristic of land development in the 48 states to the south. We now see in evolution new towns. New towns, of course, are common to many parts of Europe. I don't know whether you'd be surprised to know that there are at least 75 new towns under construction in the 48 states to the south. Some 75. Who are the sponsors of these towns? The great corporations, the Gulf Oil, the Humble Oil, Kaiser Aluminum, Alcoa, Goodyear, and insurance companies such as the Connecticut General Insurance Company, which is building the very large city of Columbia, Maryland, between Washington, D.C. and Baltimore. Obviously, these corporations have the capital. But more than that, they have the interest in community building, which indicates to me at least that they may consider community building, community management, to be one of the great investment opportunities for large corporations in the future. I'm sorry to say that most of these communities are not operating on the Irvine principle, that is, on the lease basis, but are still operating on the fee simple basis of developing and selling most of their land. For the most part, the major investors are holding the commercial lands, expecting that they will derive considerable incomes from the management of them. There is a possibility in our urban renewal, and I understand there may be an example of that going into effect here in Anchorage, of large capital accumulators coming in and buying land in already developed urban areas with the expectation that they can clear and renew those areas and put them to higher and better use. The most effective capital accumulators in our nation are the insurance companies and pension funds. And gradually they are coming into the picture in the 48 states to the south to bring together land into large units that could be managed, which is unnecessary here, I understand, in Alaska, because you already own in statewide units 99.9% of the total territory. But this same kind of instrument, the same kind of institution, it seems to me, could be applied to the uses of public lands, either state or federal or tribal. And that is, the states could grant, as they now grant to power companies and to telephone companies, franchises, giving them monopoly rights to development, but under regulations and subject to controls with definite time limitations and the expectation that they would live up to the stipulation of the agreements. I don't know whether you would find such an arrangement feasible or not in Alaska, but it's recognized that the public community must make very substantial investments to any kind of urban development. And when I'm talking about urban development, I mean now any kind of human capital investment, wherever it may be, whether it's in the cities or in the mines or in the petroleum fields or in the development of dams or highways or whatever it may be. Since the public must make these investments, it should be under some assurance as to what the private investments will be, and that there be a coordination so that waste of capital, both public and private, can be avoided, and so that the landscape itself, which results, will not deteriorate and degenerate too rapidly to recover at least the investments made, so long as they respond satisfactorily to economic need and to lifestyle needs. To the south, we have other opportunities for solving the same problem, which you wouldn't have to use here in Alaska because you do have control over land publicly, and that is time zoning rather than use zoning. To the south, we could change our zoning regulations to indicate to all small landowners in intensively urbanized areas that they could use those lands only for certain time, definite time periods. And when those time periods were up, that whole blocks of land in intensively urbanized areas would have to be subject to new options. What we're finding is that with the increasing populations and increasing concentrations of people in urbanized areas, that commitments which are made today become obsolete decades later, and some means must be provided, and by no means have I suggested all the options possible, but some means must be provided for opening up large blocks of land to new uses at a future time. We have found that the problem of urban renewal on the present basis is both inadequate and too expensive. Now, in any kind of land use, the patterns of layout and physical development must follow the functions for which that land is to be utilized. And the functions themselves follow changes in lifestyle and follow changes in technical development. Now, I'd like to draw what appears to me a parallel between the uses of land by the native tribes, wherever one might find them in the world, and I would presume that would be true of Alaska. Their approach to the use of land and what I would call possibly the new corporate use of land in the kind of technological and social world that is emerging. I'm amused by one of your brochures, your travel brochures, that shows the Alaskan natives tossing one another up into the air by what they call the blanket toss. To get a survey of the game that might lie over the ice ridges. This was an attempt to discover the important resource of that territory for the tribe which was hunting. And then I'm told that over in Spenard Lake, you have the world's largest seaplane base for private planes. And Mr. Eaton has just told me that 1 out of 5 Alaskans has a pilot license and 1 out of 8 owns a plane. And the two-plane families are more common in Alaska than two-car families are to the south. This is the modern blanket toss. The remote sensing devices, which John Osman referred to, that are over at Anchorage westward, are the sophisticated electronic descendant, let's say, of the native tribal blanket toss. And just as the game supplies move and change, and the tribes must move accordingly, following the game, I think we could look upon the natural resources of the great landscape of Alaska as being locally exhaustible and therefore requiring new blanket tosses by remote sensing electronic devices. But if they may be locally exhaustible, I would say that they would be statewide inexhaustible, for this reason, that what is locally desirable at the moment is in terms of present technology. But what may be overlooked at the moment by the remote sensing apparatus, in view of technological evolution, may be highly desirable a decade or 2 or 3 or 4 in the future. And that therefore the management of land as it has been conducted in the primitive past, and I think you're very fortunate that there's still a survival of that culture in Alaska by the tribes, in which they exploit the resources but never destroy the environment. And if that same principle could be applied to the worldwide interest in the resources of Alaska, it would be possible to exploit local resources until they are exhausted in terms of present technology, and then care be taken that those landscapes not be permanently scarred or polluted. And one of the most guilty parties in this respect, I understand, is the federal government itself in tearing up the landscape and polluting it and not making any provision for cleaning up after it has found its use, its former use, no longer compelling. So that one might see a parallel between the ways in which the native tribes have managed their land systems and the way in which a modern corporation might also manage the land systems of the state, shifting exploitations from place to place, but always maintaining some kind of executive node. It's my understanding that the native people in their wanderings and migrations have certain places to which they return, certain places which at certain seasons offer a larger food supply than at others. And at those times, they can congregate and exchange ideas and socialize. And this, it seems to me, is the function of great cities in the modern world, that they be centers where people come together and exchange ideas and socialize. And now that the world is becoming a worldwide network, the function of such cities as Anchorage and Juneau is to tie into this world management system, to locate for the world those resources which the world can use and develop without permanent damage to the Alaskan landscape. Now, in terms of the trends that now seem apparent, the urban industrial nations are finding that employment in agriculture and in manufacturing are diminishing in terms of the total population. That this function of employment in agriculture and manufacturing are being taken over by such remarkable technological changes, including the computerization, of course, of manufacturing processes. Very few people are engaged or will be engaged, at least in the next few decades, in this kind of occupation. In the United States at the moment, only 5% of our population are now engaged in agriculture, whereas approximately 70% were engaged in agriculture 100 years ago when the Homestead Act was put into effect. So you can see the completely different context in which we used land in those days and the way in which we use it now. And of that 5% who are now engaged in agriculture in the United States, only 2% are really effective producers. They produce about 87% of our agricultural produce. There are predictions that by the year 2000, there may be only 2% of our population engaged in manufacturing. And those 2%, of course, will be highly skilled engineers who are operating the automated systems. What then is happening? Where are people to be employed? Apparently, the change in the developed or urbanized world is an increasing employment in design and management. And this is the apparent important function of our cities in the future, to serve as these management centers. This is definitely a new system. And land no longer is a satisfactory source of public revenue under this kind of operation. That is, if land is no longer to be used as a commodity, then it should no longer serve as the primary basis of taxation. Our great emphasis on land as a basis of taxation goes back to our agrarian settlement, when farmers insisted that local governments be responsible for most public services. Now, this is a very practical solution because it was recognized that if public services were very expensive, it would put the farm ownership in jeopardy. And we have a tradition in this country that local government or state government should be primarily responsible for the funding of public services. If the concept of land should change as one of performing a function to make more efficient economic development and more responsive lifestyle desires, then it can no longer serve primarily as the source of income of localities through the property tax. You'd say, what would be the appropriate one? I understand that you have an income tax in Alaska, and it seemed to me that the income tax is the most appropriate tax for the kind of economy that I've been describing, for the reason that the income tax is a tax on talent. And talent is the product of the kind of educational system that we have been developing in America, a system which has up to this point been primarily financed by taxes on property. It seems rather inconsistent that localities, through the taxation of property, should bear the great burden of producing talent, which is then very heavily taxed by the federal government, which has almost no responsibility at the local level. This begins to challenge the question as to how federal funds are spent and whether there should be a much stronger commitment. And this commitment will never voluntarily be accepted by the federal government. I think they will have to be pressured into it by the actions of your local political representatives. If then I might summarize by saying that it seems to me that Alaska's resources are locally exhaustible, but statewide inexhaustible, for the reason that your prospects for inanimate energy generation can only be brighter with the passage of time through the development of hydroelectric projects, through the discovery of more fossil fuels, and through the employment ultimately of nuclear energy, and the fact that technological potential seems infinite as generated by your educational systems, and this is where the University of Alaska and other universities in your state become so important, because it is the function of the educational system, and especially of the research systems of the university, to advance the intellectual level, the talent level of populations. And these universities aren't simply local generators. The universities act as nodes in the worldwide university system. Any person specializing in university work is not simply associated with his own department. He is associated worldwide with the events in his field. And so the university system then is a part of the subsystem of any city, which acts as a node for the connection with the worldwide globalized system of our time. And this technological potential is also apparently infinite because of the inputs of private research and development and the coordination between that private research and development and what is going on in the universities, almost guarantee. I would suggest that if it weren't possible, there'd be no hope for the larger populations of humanity now coming aboard the spaceship Earth. So that it seems to me that we are emerging from a 10,000-year-old agrarian interlude.